This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Smoke and Mirrors, the 2006 election and the illusion of change. Tonight, we have made history. Now, let us make progress. Those are the words of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who's become House Speaker as a result of the 2006 elections. Tonight is a great victory for the American people, she said. Today, the American people voted for change, and they voted for Democrats to take our country in a new direction. And that is exactly what we intend to do. Do the Democratic Party legislators intend to take the United States in a new direction? That is what we'll discuss today on Taking Aim. Because as the Democratic Party took control of both houses of Congress in the November 7th midterm elections, the Democratic Party won the a 51-49 margin in the Senate. That margin, however, is dependent upon Senator Lieberman of Connecticut, who ran as an independent. That was after the Democratic Party chose Ned Lamont to run in his place. Ned Lamont, who had said he was opposed to the war in Iraq, the position of President Bush and the Republican Party towards stay the course in Iraq. Yet when it came to the election campaign, Ned Lamont became silent. Consequently, Senator Lieberman, the hawk, as he's called, is back in Congress and is the deciding vote for the Democratic Party majority in the Senate. Six Senate Republican incumbents were defeated. That is Rick Santorum in Pennsylvania, the third-ranking Republican leader. Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island, Mike DeWine of Ohio, James Talent of Missouri are among them. These are people who have been in the Senate for many, many years. In the House of Representatives, the Democrats gained a wide majority, well over the 15 they needed to become the majority party. But what does it mean? Is this a new day for the American people? Over and again, people across the United States in exit polls stated that they were opposed to the war in Iraq, that they were concerned with the economy. They were concerned with the fact that they didn't feel they had enough money and that there was uncertainty of what tomorrow would bring. Ralph?
Well, let's put this in its context, because as the bourgeois press celebrates the idea that the public had expressed its will in the elections, we have to bear in mind that the polls demonstrate that 8% of the American public, and I'm quoting from the Angus Reid Global Monitor poll, 8% of the American public supports the war in Iraq. 8%. In fact, the New York Times and CBS polls show 61% of the respondents called for a total change in U.S. strategy, and the overwhelming mass of the American people repudiate imperial policy now in Iraq. That's clear. And yet, to put this election into its proper perspective, this huge triumph, as it's being labeled, we're talking here about marginal races, races in which there were hairline majorities waiting into the late night to determine the outcome for candidates that were slightly to the right of Genghis Khan and the Democratic Party itself, to wit the senator from Virginia, Jim Webb, who was Reagan's Secretary of the Navy. And not just Reagan's Secretary of the Navy, but a hawk, as it were, on all imperial policy with respect to two parties and their presumptive stratagems. Critical to understand this. What was the outturn in the elections that we've just had? 39% of the registered voters participated in this election. 8% of the public supports the war in Iraq. 39% of the registered voters, that's roughly half of the eligible electorate, participated in this election. Call it, be generous. Call it 20%. Cut that between the two fake parties and you've got 10% of the population eligible to vote participating in this. But 92% of the American people repudiate the war in Iraq. What does this actually tell us? That the people of the United States are on to the two-party con. They have vanishingly little expectation and illusion about these two parties, and there's good reason for that. The Democratic Party takes control of both houses, and the Democratic Party, as all of the media have established, ran candidates who were, quote, conservative. The Democratic Party and Pelosi recruited those. As the World Socialist website put it, election campaign reveals Democrats lurch to the right.
Now, Ralph, let's look at some of these Democratic Party candidates, in particular James Webb of Virginia, James Webb, of whom Nancy Pelosi is so proud. James Webb is the most prominent example of the Democratic Party candidates for the House and Senate who is a Republican turned Democrat. As you said, he had been the Secretary of the Navy for Ronald Reagan in the Reagan administration. Webb is a decorated Marine officer in the Vietnam War. He's the author of half a dozen novels on his U.S. military experience in the Vietnam War, and he's much praised by the right-wing press. He was not just the Secretary of the Navy. He held other positions. Let's look at what he has actually said. It's because he was heavily promoted by the National Democratic Party leadership. Now, they endorsed Webb over Harris Miller. Harris Miller, although a multimillionaire, is considered a traditional liberal and a longtime Democrat. And remember, Webb was a Republican who turned Democrat. And there was a primary, and this Democratic Party primary, only 3% of those eligible to vote in the Democratic Party primary actually participated. And compare that for what you were saying with the 39%. Here we have the choice of the candidate in Virginia was made by only 3% of the Democratic Party members, registered Democrats, voting. So let's look again at some of Webb's position. Webb has said that he is opposed to the war. He is not opposed to the war, as you and I are opposed to the war on the grounds of American imperialism. No, he is opposed to the war in Iraq because he says it denies the United States, quote, the mobility to confront the other strategic challenges, such as the threat of an emerging China.
Well, Maya Webb is merely stating that he's opposed to the insufficient number of troops that have been allocated to win the war in Iraq. He is opposed to the war as conducted on the basis of what they call Rumsfeld's plan, and Rumsfeld is merely the scapegoat here, because the entire ruling class was in lockstep over this. And we have to keep in mind that the Democratic Party had a majority control of the Senate when the war was launched. They supported this war. They voted for this war. They backed this war. They embraced this war. They utilized the Democratic control of the Senate in order to facilitate it. And as to James Webb, who is the Secretary of Navy under Reagan, he epitomizes what the Democratic Party really represents in respect to the stratagems of the ruling class. And we can detail this. We have to keep in mind that Hillary Clinton, New York's incumbent Democratic senator, supposedly the front runner for the 2008 presidential nomination, not only embraces the war in Iraq, but supports the waterboarding torture and indeed a preemptive strike on Iran, but enjoyed the support of Rupert Murdoch's New York Post, which is infamous for its semi-fascist diatribes against the working class, anyone who challenges the far right's political agenda. More instructive, Illinois Congressman Rahm Emanuel, head of the Democratic Party's Congressional Campaign Committee, played the decisive role in selecting new candidates for the House of Representatives and rejecting others who were liberal or, quote, too forthright in voicing opposition to the Iraq War, unquote. Now, Emanuel published a book which was co-authored by the Democratic Leadership Council's Bruce Reed, and it is entitled The Plan. If you want to understand what the Democratic Party agenda is with respect to Iraq, it's all spelled out. A new strategy to win the war on terror. That's the gravamen of this book called The Plan. And it calls, by the way, so be very clear about this, a new mandatory program of universal citizen service. All Americans between the ages of 18 and 25 will be asked to serve their country by going through 3 months of basic defense training preparatory to what? Service in Iraq. They don't call it a draft. They just lay out the basis for the draft. That's the plan. We need to fortify, and I'm quoting, the military's thin green line around the world. We must add to our special forces and Marines and expand the army by 100,000 more troops. Quote, unquote, the plan, the Democratic Party plan, the plan of the architect of the congressional campaign, the plan of the director of the selection of the candidates. That is to say, the determination that only those who are, quote, conservative, unquote, and what do these words mean anymore, slightly to the right of Genghis Khan, as I say, that is to say, people who embrace entirely the stratagems of a continued imperium in the Arab East.
Ralph, I'd like to go back to Webb again, because the agenda of Webb is, when it comes to war and the imperial adventures, very much the neocon agenda that we've discussed in World War IV in the past on Taking Aim. Because, as you say, his concerns about Iraq are strategic concerns. But he talks over and again about the threat of China, the threat of Iran, the threat of North Korea, and also Russia. But particularly the threat of China. And this, again, is what the neocons have been promoting over and again, that we have to look to the East. We have to look to the rise of the economic development of China and what that poses as a military threat. And this is what we have as the new Democrat with James Webb in Virginia. And then there's Robert Casey in Pennsylvania. Here we have an example of a longtime Democrat, Robert Casey, now senator from Pennsylvania, moving from the House to the Senate, a longtime political family. And Robert Casey, and I quote here, stating, quote, believes that our nation must be committed to crushing the threat of terrorism, end quote, and pledges to, quote, push the White House and the Pentagon to redouble efforts to capture or kill bin Laden and crush the terrorist threat.
Well, Maya, look, let's look at this carefully. What, as I say, what do these labels mean? The Democratic Party is a policy instrument for politics that would have been considered too far right during the Reagan era for the Republican Party. Let's take, we've mentioned Hillary Clinton. New York Congressman Charles Rangel, who as the Los Angeles Times labeled him the most liberal figure in the House of Representatives, poised to become chairman of the Tax Writing Ways and Means Committee when the Democrats gain control of the House. Well, he gave an interview last week, quote, the Democrats will not retroactively roll back the tax cut. And furthermore, he refused to state that the Democratic Party would oppose the expansion of the tax windfalls for the super rich when the issue becomes due in 2010. An article in the Los Angeles Times documents the soaring corporate contributions for Democratic Party candidates. And Rangel has benefited handsomely for his pro-corporate politics because the article establishes that the principal contributor to Rangel's campaign was General Electric. They gave him double what they had contributed to candidates in the previous electoral cycle. I don't think meeting with the chairman of General Electric has anything to do with my taking over the Ways and Means Committee, Rangel joked cynically. I just never realized how much they loved me, unquote. Well, they love him, and it's a match made in heaven, because the corporate intelligence is not lacking in perception as to who they buy and what they obtain when they put down their money. The Democratic Party and the liberal wing of it, as it's called, the so-called liberal wing, is simply an instrument of the corporate agenda. Now, to put this in its proper perspective, and we'll deal with Nancy Pelosi in a moment, the first thing that Ms. Pelosi declared upon her becoming the Speaker of the House pro tem was that not only, quote, as the San Francisco Chronicle described it, will we make nice with George Bush, but, quote, impeachment is off the table. Well, that, I think, is of particular interest, not because we have any illusion or expectation that the Democratic Party had the slightest intention of impeaching George Bush, not for the torture, not for the imperial agenda, not for the lying in Iraq, not for, needless to say, for organizing and instituting 9/11 as an inside job. But the architect of the impeachment claim, Representative John Conyers of the Black Caucus, who had written a 360-page documentary report on the items of impeachment for George W. Bush. What did John Conyers declare immediately upon the end of the election? Quote, why impeachment is off the agenda.
Ralph, his exact words. Quote, in this campaign, there was an orchestrated right-wing effort to distort my position on impeachment, he said in a statement released by his Judiciary Committee spokesman. The incoming speaker, Representative Nancy Pelosi, has said that impeachment is off the table. I am in total agreement with her on this issue. And as you said, he had issued previously the 350-page report, The Constitution in Crisis. Now, let's look at a quote from this report. Conyers had stated in December 2005, when he had released the 350-page report, quote, the report concludes that a number of these actions, referring to the actions of President Bush, amount to prima facie evidence. And prima facie means evidence that's sufficiently strong to presume that the allegations are true. The prima facie evidence that federal criminal laws have been violated. Now, I'm quoting from Conyers. Legal violations span from false statements to Congress to whistleblower laws. The report also concludes that these charges clearly rise to the level of impeachable conduct. And Conyers went on to say, Ralph, that in response to the report, I have already taken a number of actions. First, I have introduced a resolution, which was H.R. 635, creating a select committee with subpoena authority to investigate the misconduct of the Bush administration with regard to the Iraq War and to report on, and this is quoting again, remember, possible impeachable offenses. Now the election is over, and Conyers comes out and says, the incoming speaker has said that impeachment is off the table. I am in total agreement with her on this issue.
Yes, Maya, to put this in its perspective again, when the Israelis invaded Lebanon, and remember we did a series on this, and we established that the pretext for raiding Lebanon, namely the presumptive...
Invading
mm-hmm. Lebanon, the presumptive capture, or what they call kidnapping, of Israeli soldiers in the north of Israel was in fact a fake operation. It was a false flag operation. All of the press reveals that in fact the Israelis staged a raid on a town in the southern Lebanon and their soldiers were captured by the defending fighters. That notwithstanding, immediately in Congress, a resolution, 1703, was put forward, which, as Brzezinski said, was not merely lobbied for by APEC and the Israeli lobby, but written by them. 1703 called for not only full armed support for the Israeli attack on Lebanon, but the expansion of this to Syria and Iran. This was supported by the overwhelming majority of the Democratic Party in Congress, and in particular, let's note what occurred with respect to this resolution. All the Democrats voted for it, but in particular, the members of the Black Caucus, and I'm talking here about people like John Conyers and Barbara Lee and Cynthia McKinney, they abstained. Dennis Kucinich abstained. They didn't vote against this resolution. The Democrats either voted for it or these Conyers types abstained. So the Black Caucus is of Democrats in Congress. The Black bourgeoisie, as represented by the caucus in Congress, exemplifies what Malcolm meant when he said, "It's not about a black face in a high place." These are instruments of the ruling class. The Democratic Party is its primary expression, and there is the reality here. You can't slide a piece of paper between these two parties.
Let's look at another one of these new Democrats, Representative John Murtha, Democrat, Pennsylvania, 37-year Marine vet, a former war supporter. And I say he's quoted as a former war supporter. In fact, he still supports the war. Close ally of Nancy Pelosi. In fact, the person that Nancy Pelosi has put forward as the majority leader for the Democrats, there's going to be a little battle there. And she has used Murtha, the Democratic Party has used Murtha as the face of their supposed anti-war stance. He announced that the Iraq war was a failure, and he called on President Bush for an early withdrawal, to have some staged plan. But let's look at some of Murtha's other positions. The website Project Vote Smart elucidates on the positions of the various congressmen with respect to the platforms of national organizations. And they have an entire list of issues, and you can go issue by issue to find out how the candidates, not the candidates, how the congresspeople have voted, not just in the past elections, but in many prior elections, and how they align themselves with various interests. And I went particularly for Murtha to abortion issues, because when you think of the Democratic Party, at least, you think as a woman about the support for the right to choose, a defining line for the people who believe in, let's say, lesser evilism. The people will say, particularly women, that at least if you vote for Democrats, you can be sure they're going to defend the right to choose and maybe push back some of the anti-abortion measures that have been the flow of Congress in the past years. Well, let's look at Jack Murtha's positions. 2006, Representative Murtha supported the interests of Planned Parenthood. 0%. 0% aligning himself with the right to choose. But 2005 to 2006, the misnamed National Right to Life Committee, 70% alignment for Congressman Jack Murtha.
Well, Murtha is the person that Pelosi wants to put in command of the troops, as it were, the Democratic Party functionaries who are in the House. You mentioned his position on abortion. That's not just an abstract idea. The Murtha position on abortion, which is now going to take the lead in regard to what the Democratic Party does in Congress, has translated into the elimination of any support or aid or international measures which don't eliminate abortion proceedings, cutting off aid to United Nations agencies unless they preclude abortion. 20 million women have died in 1 year globally because of the use of illegal or dangerous abortions.
Ralph, I have to correct you here. It's not that 20 million women have died. There are 20 million unsafe abortions and 70,000 women die.
Oh, I'm sorry, but is that
That's globally, yes.
Yes, okay.
Yes. 70,000 is a lot of women.
Right.
But if you consider that 20 million women potentially could have died because of unsafe abortions.
Well, of course, one of the aspects of the 20 million, and you're quite right, it isn't a 20 million death figure, but the unsafe abortions that result in 70,000 deaths annually result in disfigurement and injury and the inability to bear children in the future and a series of consequential ailments that flow from this. But coming to the question of Murtha's relationship to Pelosi and the Democratic Party with respect to his position about opposition to the war in Iraq, their position about Iraq is that the staged withdrawal of U.S. troops is in relation to the, quote, stabilization of Iraq and the securing of United States interests there. And the real convergence, as it's called, between the neocons and the liberals on Iraq has to do with the actual plans of both the Pelosi and the Democratic Party and the Baker Commission that is being the Iraq study group that we're going to discuss in a few moments, because those plans were made very clear by the senator from New York, Charles Schumer, who, by the way, was the actual organizer for the Democratic Party of the election campaign. He, designated by Howard Dean, was the strategist for the Democratic Party campaign in 2006. Charles Schumer has declared very explicitly and clearly that the Democratic Party plan, as it's called, for Iraq is to fragment Iraq into at least three sub-states, Sunni, Shia, and Kurdish. And that the stabilization of Iraq that they have in mind is the elimination of Iraq as a nation. Now, that plan is the Joe Biden plan.
The Democratic senator from Delaware.
The Democratic senator from Delaware, Joseph Biden, who along with Lawrence Gelb, and Gelb, by the way, is a former...
Leslie Gelb,
H. Gelb is... is a former principal editor of the New York Times. He's also the chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations. Mr. Gelb and Senator Biden have advanced a specific plan for the dividing of Iraq into three separate sub-states. They will have a shared revenue, but they will have their own armies and they will be autonomous. And in fact, Biden holds out the example of that wonderful Democratic Party achievement in Yugoslavia. The flooding of the country with depleted uranium, the saturation bombing of Yugoslavia, the fragmentation of Yugoslavia into sub-states, the total destruction of it as a viable industrial nation, that indeed is the model that Biden presents, that Murtha embraces, that Pelosi entails for the future of Iraq. And that happens to be the neocon agenda, as articulated, and we've described it over a period of 25 years now, as we wrote about it in The Hidden History of Zionism, the Oded Yinon plan for fragmenting. It's called a strategy for the 1980s. It was a Mossad document. It was the predicate for the entire neocon agenda in the war on terror, as General Shinseki declared with respect to Paul Wolfowitz. In the late 70s, they already had laid out the intention of fragmenting each Middle Eastern country into its ethnic and religious components. And lest there be any ambiguity or doubt about this, brothers and sisters, on June 6th of 2006, in the Armed Forces Journal, Colonel Ralph Peters wrote a seminal article called Blood Borders. And he produces the map that both Charles Schumer and Joseph Biden are relying upon now, not merely for the fragmentation of Iraq, but the dividing of each Arab and Middle Eastern state into ethnic and religious components. This is an all-out assault upon the national identity, upon the anti-colonial revolution, upon the capacity of the oppressed populations of the region, of Central Asia and the Middle East, to cohere a national resistance to colonial despoliation and the imperial agenda. It is that that the Democratic Party is putting forward. And to put this again into its proper perspective, former Secretary of State James Baker, who is the consigliere of Bush Sr. and the Bush family and of Scowcroft, he is heading up this so-called Iraq study group with whom? With Hamilton, Lee Hamilton, the Democratic Party leader, who was the facilitator for the first Gulf War along with James Baker. Parenthetically, brothers and sisters, James Baker, the main architect of Bush Sr.'s policies, is a lifelong Democrat who signed on for George Bush Sr. because there is a total convergence between these two parties, the one big property party with two names.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Smoke and Mirrors, the 2006 Election and the Illusion of Change. Ralph, we were speaking about the Biden plan promoted by Charles Schumer on television soon as the election so-called victory was announced.
He went on Bill Maher, the HBO liberal loudmouth, I suppose you could call him. The louder the voice gets, the emptier the head gets. But that aside, Bill Maher is a consummate liberal and Zionist who attacks Bush, usually from the right. And he had on Charles Schumer, the senator from New York, and Schumer laid out his plan because Maher pushed him. Well, what did the Democrats really intend to do about Iraq? You know, we don't really want to leave a vacuum there. At the same time, the policies are not working, Maher says, so what's your plan? And Schumer laid it out. He said, well, we will have a stabilization through the breaking up of Iraq into ethnic components, what he called autonomy regions for Sunni, Shia, and Kurd, so that the United States doesn't have to police a civil war. And the oil revenues, well, the United States will police how they're shared out, which translates very clearly to the same old, U.S. imperialism will have control over the oil, and the little bit of revenue sharing that will be allotted will be handed out to the various ethnic components. Of course, this scenario presupposes that you have a passive population that's simply going to acquiesce in the carving up of their country as if the U.S. is the master of this scenario. These people are smoking opium, but they are united in their particular addiction, Democrat and Republican alike.
Ralph, our listeners, brothers and sisters, can read more about the Biden plan. On May 1st, 2006, Joseph Biden, senior Democrat on the House Foreign Relations Committee, probably will be chair now, and Leslie Gelb, the head of the Council on Foreign Relations, had an op-ed piece in the New York Times, Unity Through Autonomy in Iraq, in which they spelled out what they call the third way that would wind down our military presence responsibly while preventing chaos and preserving our key security goals. They then repeated it August 24th, 2006, in the Washington Post, with another op-ed piece called A Plan to Hold Iraq Together. Imagine the doublespeak here as they're dividing Iraq, if they're fragmenting it, they call it the plan to hold Iraq together. And again, on Joseph Biden's website, which is http://biden.senate.gov, he has a fact sheet, the Biden Plan for Iraq, where he spells out his, quote, third way and gives the five-point plan. One, establish Iraq with three regions, three what he calls largely autonomous regions with a strong but limited, notice the limited, central government in Baghdad. Well, what is the purpose of this special central government? And you guessed it. You guessed it correctly. It is to control the oil production revenues. And the oil production revenues, that means the foreign concessions, the flow of oil to the United States, and the parceling of the revenues guaranteeing the Sunni population 20%, because they're 20% of the population, he says, so that they will go along with this fragmentation. And the second part of the five-point plan was to share the oil revenues, as I mentioned before. Third, to increase reconstruction assistance. As you may be aware, President Bush has cut off, has not renewed any of the reconstruction money that flowed to the large corporations like Bechtel and Halliburton, and supposed jobs program. We're all aware of the effective jobs programs that have been established in the United States, I add sarcastically, and you can imagine for Iraq. And the purpose of this jobs program, it's a carrot and stick, is to provide some money which will then have a condition to protect the minority and women's rights, and to give a program for Iraqi youth, which they say is an alternative to militia and criminal gangs. Again, as you say, they're smoking opium. Engage the neighbors. That's number four. Neighbors, mind you, is the term he uses, as if everybody's living in a suburban development, and these are the people next door, in order to maintain Iraq's territorial integrity. And the U.S., which just walks all over the United Nations, which is a fig leaf organization. Anyway, he says that the UN would convene a regional security conference. And last but not least, draw down U.S. troops, but of course keep special forces, at least 20,000, as a concentration against any terrorist activities.
This is the language of Orwell. Maintaining the territorial integrity of Iraq under the Biden plan means dividing the country into four parts. That's maintaining its territorial integrity.
The fourth part, Ralph, being Baghdad under the control with the humongous American embassy, which is as large as Vatican City, cost $500 billion to build.
Well, that, of course, tells you.
$500 billion.
What would the Democrats do about Iraq, asks the Christian Science Monitor on the 31st of October. In poll after poll, prospective voters name Iraq as the number one issue in the upcoming midterm elections. And it goes on to explain how the public has turned on the war in its entirety. Democrats could conceivably view such an election outcome as a mandate for asserting a markedly different course in Iraq, but don't expect much, experts say. And it goes on to explain the differences between Bush and the Democrats on the large foreign policy issues are solely a matter of detail. And the article is an articulation of the fact that the plans that are being canvassed are canvassed in conjunction with the leaders of both parties and with all factions of the ruling elite, as they call it, the ruling class, in short. When you have Leon Panetta, who is the former chief of staff for Clinton, at his institute in the Bay Area, bringing together James Baker and the Democratic Party leadership for a common plan on Iraq, you have the picture very clear. Now, here is the San Francisco Chronicle after the election on November 12th. No pullout intended. No pullout intended as the bishop said to the actress, no pullout intended indeed. That's what the Democratic Party is doing to the public in the United States. And here, indeed, is the San Francisco Chronicle. Pelosi and Bush make nice over White House lunch. Future Speaker of the House states they will work together. And it goes into the detail of what working together means. They intend to collaborate on the strategy for Iraq. Withdrawal is within the context of permanent U.S. control and presence. George and Nancy make nice. Reconciliation between Democrats and the unitary decider. Quote, Associated Press. Within hours of an election that puts Democrats in charge of the House and Senate for the final 2 years of Bush's presidency, the president and the woman who will be the House Speaker have solidified their reconciliation, and they have put forward what will become a joint plan for the address of the United States to the crisis in Iraq. New York Times calls for more troops in Iraq. A detailed plan, again a plan. October 26th, the intention is not to decrease in the guise of withdrawal. They intend to increase the number of troops. They intend to, quote, stabilize Baghdad. This is the title of the editorial, Stabilize Baghdad. The problem is not one of military strategy. The problem is that the commanders have been given a fraction of the troops that they need. There have never been enough troops. This page is opposed to a needless and hurried and unilateral invasion, the editorial declares. They want a multilateral invasion. What is that invasion about? They spell it out. The destruction of the Shia militia and the working class sectors of Baghdad in which the Shia have virtual autonomous control. And here is Howard Dean. No fast U.S. shift on Iraq if Democrats win. Even if Democrats win control of the Congress and elections, a change in course in Iraq policy is unlikely, the party's chairman stated on Sunday. Reuters, November 8th, Iraqi skeptical Democratic gains mean change. Iraqi leaders predicted that there will be no change in U.S.-Iraq policy, and ordinary citizens doubt any U.S. party will restore their wrecked country after Democrats swept midterm elections and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld quit. Here is David Brooks in the New York Times on the 12th talking about Iraq. Both parties are desperate to be able to solve the problem of Iraq by 2008. What does that solution entail? There are private conversations about a bipartisan strategy and an end to the campaign season. They are shelving all calls for imminent withdrawal. The Democratic Party is on board, and even John Murtha, who thinks Iraq is unsalvageable, and Joe Biden, who argues that a change of policy is still possible to head off a full disaster, are in basic agreement about what is to be done. That is to say, segment Iraq. The country is segmenting organically. According to the United Nations, 365 Iraqis have fled their homes and communities since February. Over 50,000 are retreating to their sectarian homelands every month.
Rob, 365,000.
What did I say?
365.
Oh, excuse me. You're quite right, Maya. 365,000 indeed, and 50,000 are retreating to what the article's column calls their sectarian homelands every month. The generals are feeling the pressure in the light of the growing fragmentation of the country. Well, this is a self-fulfilling prophecy. The devastation of Iraq is such that not only 655,000 Iraqis are the official number of those that have died, which is roughly 7 million population equivalent in the United States, but over 1 million Iraqis are refugees within Iraq, which is the equivalent of 13 million people in the United States. This country has been totally devastated, totally subjected to unrelenting destruction. There's no electric power. There's no viable water. There's no sewage system. The food is a very chancy privilege for the vast majority of the population in Iraq. This was a thriving industrial nation before U.S. imperialism laid its hands upon it. And they want to do what? They want to solidify the fragmentation of Iraq that they have been so arduously undertaking to impose.
And Ralph, we should also mention that this was a unified and country in democratic country prior to the United States through the CIA assassination of Abdul Karim Qasim and the imposition of Saddam Hussein upon the Iraqi people. Because remember, Saddam Hussein was a construct of the CIA. I think we also need to discuss Iran, Ralph, because this is another avenue where there is a conjoining of interests of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And Bush has been so criticized and seen the criticism from the American people, he is upping the ante on he's revving up about his attack and the seeking regime change in Iran. And three particular Democrats to look at are Congressman Tom Lantos from California, considered by many to be a pro-labor and a liberal congressman, but in fact he is the chief Zionist, I would say, leading the charge for the Zionist state and Zionist interests in the House of Representatives. And Tom Lantos has stated, he's, by the way, the one of the authors, he co-sponsored the a bill that calls for sanctions on Iran, and he supported the first Gulf War. He authorized the second Gulf War. He supports the Israeli assault on Lebanon, and he vowed to Israel's Prime Minister Ehud Olmert that he will block any aid to Lebanon until Lebanon agrees to have international troops on the border with Syria. He also calls for intervention in Sudan. But most of all, he is for extreme attacks on Iran, particularly primarily to begin with drastic sanctions. And then we also have Hillary Clinton. She has criticized the Bush administration for being too soft on Iran. And I quote here from Hillary, quote, "I believe we lost critical time in dealing with Iran because the White House chose to downplay the threats and to outsource the negotiation. I don't believe you face threats like Iran or North Korea by outsourcing it to others and standing on the sidelines." And the key words here is not the fact of using other countries to negotiate with Iran or North Korea. The key words are threats like Iran and North Korea.
Well, the agenda is shared. Every administration since 1964 had prepared for direct seizure of Arab oil and Middle Eastern oil in the region. Iran from 1953 was targeted by U.S. imperialism when the national government of Mossadegh was overthrown and the Shah imposed by the CIA and the Savak constructed by the Mossad and the Central Intelligence Agency. And once again, Iran is targeted for fragmentation, and they all share in this. It was the Carter administration's Brzezinski that organized the invasion of Iran by Iraq at a meeting in Kuwait between Saddam Hussein and King Fahd and Asaba, the Emir of Kuwait, and Brzezinski. The Biden plan, which is a plan for Iraq, is not confined to Iraq. The plan for so-called unity through autonomy, which is a code and euphemistic language for fragmenting these countries, it's spelled out in the Washington Post on November 12th by Michael Abramovitz and Thomas Ricks, with reference to the Iraq Study Group, the, quote, 10-member bipartisan Iraq Study Group, which, by the way, is divided equally between Republicans and Democrats, and led by James A. Baker III and former Congressman Lee Hamilton, as we've mentioned. Panel has few good options to offer. Bipartisan group plan expected in December. It will appeal to both parties. The Democrats have something to support after a campaign in which they criticized Bush's Iraq policy, but have not offered many specifics of their own, the Washington Post tells us. Baker's objectives for the Iraq Study Group are grounded in his conviction that Iraq is the central foreign policy issue confronting the United States, and the only way to address that issue successfully is to build a bipartisan consensus, said Arnold Kunter, who was the Undersecretary of State under Baker during George H.W. Bush's administration. And his bland language continues to explain how Hamilton concedes the obstacles ahead. Obstacles ahead. You have a devastated land in which the entire population is in insurgency. The United States, indeed, and the Zionists, the Mossad, are the principal instruments of the internecine ethnic attacks between Shia and Sunni on the civilian populations. These are staged operations repeatedly designed to prevent the cohesive resistance from Shia and Sunni alike to U.S. imperial design. That's why the Shia leadership of the puppet government itself won't impose the draconian measures that on their own civilian populations in Baghdad that the U.S. is demanding. Here, McCain and Lieberman. John McCain, the Republican senator from Arizona, who has been embraced by Pelosi and the Democrats, has joined with Lieberman to express support for sending more troops to Iraq. This is a joint declaration by the, as you called him, the pivotal person of the Democrats in the Senate, Lieberman, who is basically the senator from Tel Aviv, and John McCain, who have declared that they're going to send more troops to Iraq. Well, that's okay, brothers and sisters. So does the New York Times call for more troops in Iraq. Even as they're talking about staged withdrawals, they're preparing for the you know how many troops have served in Iraq, brothers and sisters? 1 million U.S. soldiers have been in this Iraq war. 1 million. The 140,000 troops there are rotated. 1 million. 40% of the troops that have been in Iraq have had life-lasting injuries. They are maimed. 40% of the troops have been maimed who have been in Iraq. It's an extraordinary number.
Ralph.
We don't even begin to understand the full ramifications of the sacrifice of this generation in Iraq. Just as 250,000 soldiers, Gulf War soldiers, had permanent neurological injury from the imposed anthrax vaccinations and the depleted uranium, I don't even begin to talk here about what have been the consequences for the Iraqi population at large of the epidemic of thalidomide-like deformities that have characterized the biological agents that have been imposed upon the Iraqi people.
Well, Ralph, we will continue this next week, but what your statistics that you're citing come from the brilliant piece by Linda Bilmes and Joseph Stiglitz, the more than $2 trillion war that appeared in Commentary November 1st. And 20% of the survivors of the soldiers have suffered major head and spinal injuries. 18% incurred serious wounds, and 6% are amputees. This is a very high number. 7,000 veterans have severe brain spinal amputation and other serious injuries that require a lifetime of round-the-clock care. If you look just at the Veterans Administration, the claims of beneficiaries, there's a backlog of 400,000 pending claims, and 250,000 new beneficiaries were added in just the past year. That's 650,000 in just between the pending and the new beneficiaries the past year.
And just to put this in its proper perspective, the authors of this report and what they call the $2 trillion war, as they are the first to acknowledge, and we're going to go into this report next week in more detail. As I said, 40% of Gulf War veterans are disabled, and that number is replicated in the current conflict. But the calculation about the cost of this war, just in terms of the United States, they call it a more than $2 trillion war. That's based upon a $10 increase in the cost of oil, when in fact oil has been increased by $45 a barrel since the war. In other words, it's not $2 trillion by their own calculation, and we'll go through this next week. It's $3.6 trillion, and that's only within the United States itself. We won't talk about the ramifications for peoples outside the United States. $3.6 trillion, while $36 million was made personally by Cheney from the Halliburton pillage and rapine exploitation of the population in Iraq. $3.6 trillion, $1 trillion, as we have often stated, is $1,000 a minute since the birth of Jesus, brothers and sisters. That is imperialism. That is the collusion of the one big property party with two names. That is their agenda for the American people. It is more war, more troops, more suffering, more waste of our hard-earned labor-produced value. And the correlative of that, which we will again go into, is the preparations for massive repression, indeed martial law, within our national frontiers. It is a two-party, one-party agenda, one big property party with two names. We have to be clear about the nature of this apparatus, brothers and sisters. Join us next week in the discussion not only of what it entails for us on a day-to-day basis, but what is to be done.
This has been Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Smoke and Mirrors, the 2006 election and the illusion of change. We'll continue with this discussion next week. Meanwhile, you can hear this program on our archive, www.takingaim.info, where you'll find our past programs too, and on the WBAI archive at www.wbai.org. Please contact us at takingaim@pacbell, that's PACBELL.net.